Today on Wings, Mary Wood, law professor at the University of Oregon, talks with Sue Supriano, producer of Steppin' Out of Babylon, about what we have to do to keep our atmosphere livable and have fun at the same time.
I approach this issue as much as a mother, as a law professor. Our actions will literally determine the fate of our children and all of their descendants. And I think back to what my ancestors did to conserve nature generations ago.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
If you had an account with real assets that was being managed for you, you wouldn't just let your bank give away the money. We are all beneficiaries with a property interest in the atmosphere, and we have to start now holding our trustees accountable.
Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's organize, unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited that I'm finally able to connect with Mary Wood here in Eugene, Oregon. Mary Wood is a professor at the law school here at the University of Oregon, and she's worked hard on developing a really novel legal framework to confront the global warming crisis in the courts. That's one of the things I've seen your PowerPoint, Mary. It's very impressive. I wish everyone could see it, but this is audio. And you also work a lot with Native people, and so we'll be talking about those two things, and I'm sure they overlap a lot. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Climate change is something that I've been talking about for quite a while, and all the really serious environmental things that are going on in the world today. And people mostly just blow it off, basically. They don't want to think about it. And you've been thinking about it a lot. I would really appreciate it if you would tell us your plan for how it can really make a difference and put the stop as much as possible on climate change. And maybe begin with a little bit about where things are at right now. And right now is June in 2009, and they're changing very quickly. So you probably have an updated information about where we're at right now. Are we past the tipping point?
Well, that's the question everybody wants an answer for, and we just can't say. But I think the only way to proceed is as if we are not past the tipping point yet. There are certainly scientists, some of the best climate scientists in the world, are saying we're not past it yet. We will soon be past it if we don't radically reduce our carbon emissions. The scientists are saying things they've never said before. They're saying our carbon pollution will cause literally a, quote, transformed planet, end quote. They are saying that this is a threat to humanity, to civilization as we know it. Basically, I do agree with you. A lot of people are not taking this issue seriously. And I would urge all parents to look their children in the eyes.
And you have three children, I didn't say, and are a fourth generation Oregonian. I've left that out. So you yourself have a little kid.
Yes, I do. And I approach this issue as much as a mother, as a law professor. And I think back to what my ancestors did to conserve nature generations ago. And so we are at a point in history now where our actions will literally determine the fate of our children and all of their descendants. The dean of Yale School of Forestry has just written a book called The Bridge at the Edge of the World by James Speth, in which he says, literally, if we keep on doing tomorrow what we did today, literally, just live our lives the same way. The world, in his very words, won't be fit to live in by mid-century. I urge people to look at the children today and think a 10-year-old will be, by 2050, a 10-year-old will be 40 years old, and the world won't be fit to live in. This is absolutely a matter of survival. It is not an environmental issue. It is a survival issue and a civilizational issue. This is by far the most important issue facing everybody, whether they recognize it or not. It surpasses health care, it surpasses tax reform, it surpasses everything. And in fact, all health and security and children's issues are all tied up in this. We cannot hope to survive in a world that is experiencing runaway heating. And that's what happens if we pass the tipping point.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure for me to hear you say it so bluntly, because, I mean, it's not happy news, but it's so important, and, like, you don't hear it too often. So let us know about your plan for making a really big difference, a public trust doctrine.
I've taught environmental law for 17 or 18 years, and you would think that environmental law would be relevant to control carbon pollution. But so far, it's been completely ineffectual. And people rely on environmental law thinking, oh, environmental law will save us. Things must be fine. We've got the best environmental laws in the world, which we do. The fact is that environmental law is very dysfunctional. It is not functioning. The agencies have still not regulated carbon pollution, even though it's the most lethal pollution that has now faced the planet. They haven't regulated it. The Environmental Protection Agency was petitioned back in 1999, 10 years ago, to regulate carbon pollution, and the EPA has still not regulated it. The reason for this is because Congress vests agencies with discretion to make the right decision. They're supposed to be neutral, objective players, and they're supposed to make the right decision for the public. What really happens, and everybody knows it inside the system, is the agencies are politicized. What happens is industries that make profits off carbon pollution put high politicians in office. This happened in the Bush administration, not the Obama administration, but the Bush administration. And then the high-level political appointees from that president ran the show for 8 years. They also brought other people within the agencies, and those people resisted regulation at every single point. They distorted the science. There's been congressional investigations and reports detailing how the Bush administration distorted the science behind climate so as to not regulate. This is not just a problem of the Bush administration. This is a problem of environmental law. The public has come to believe that environmental protection is a political issue. And my proposal is to completely reframe environmental law, not leave protection up to the discretion of the agencies. Environmental law should impose this protection as an obligation of all governmental agencies. So I view nature out there as something like a college account. It's a trust. It's a trust that the people hold and own for future generations. So all of the air, the atmosphere, the wildlife, the wetlands, the waters, the forests, those are natural assets held in trust, managed by government, and they have to be managed to protect the assets so that they will support the survival of children in this nation and across the world in perpetuity. That is completely 180 degrees from the current model, which allows government to issue licenses to pollute the resources until they can no longer sustain human life. So my theory is, or my approach is called nature's trust. It imposes a firm obligation on government, and all the people out there listening to this radio show can view themselves not so much as constituents of this process, but as beneficiaries. As if you had an account with real assets that was being managed for you, you wouldn't just let your bank give away the money. We are all beneficiaries with a property interest in the atmosphere, and we have to start now holding our trustees accountable.
Mm-hmm. Really. I wonder about these people that don't pay attention with so much power. I mean, they have kids, too. It's just mind-boggling to me. Do you have any ideas about that, the psychology of this?
Well, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. I'm not a psychologist, but there's certainly a lot of attention from the field of psychology to this issue, and it's just very well known that the human brain has a tremendous filter system, and what gets through is usually the warnings that some basic survival is at stake. And so far, the government has been very clever in muting the climate science, so that message just hasn't gotten through. The scientists themselves have now taken to the airwaves. They are now saying civilization is at stake. This is a matter of life and death. It is a matter of your children's life and death. So I think that a lot of people are now waking up to that, but we need more ordinary people bringing that message to other ordinary people. Because when you wake up in the morning and you read the headlines, you might hear about a massive drought one day, a massive flood the next day, the sixth greatest extinction in the history of the world the next day, but you don't connect those things. So we need ordinary people really conveying the urgency to other people.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds right to me. So wake up, folks, if you're not already awake. So would you like to explain, Mary Wood, about what you propose?
Well, in terms of what an ordinary citizen can do, this is a planetary emergency. It's unlike any emergency we've ever faced. But all of the climate scientists and policymakers are urging sort of a World War II model of response. Literally, we have to engage every single sector of society and make changes to reduce carbon dramatically.
So carbon really is the main issue. I mean, there are people who argue about that, of course.
Well, human-caused pollution is what we can control, and that's the main driver. And there's two big ones, but more also. But the two big ones are carbon dioxide and methane. And we can certainly control those. We can move from fossil fuels. We have to eliminate, basically, our dependency on all fossil fuels, meaning coal primarily and oil and gas, and move into solar energy, tidal, geothermal, and maybe other sources of energy. So the number one thing people can do is stop any more coal-fired plants and retire the existing coal-fired plants and let the wind and solar energy create all of the energy that we need for survival in this country. That is the main thing. The second thing is, of course, transportation. People need to completely rework their entire lifestyles. And this isn't just about changing a light bulb. It is literally about reducing carbon on a personal level, first by 50%, and then moving on from there. The scientists warn us that we are looking the tipping point in the eye. Now, if we pass the tipping point, there's literally no redemption, because the tipping point means that we have catalyzed processes in nature that are called feedbacks. If we get those feedbacks going, it will cause runaway climate change out of our control, meaning that there's a few feedbacks that we think about. One is that the forests have absorbed much of our carbon pollution, but because we've caused 1 degree Fahrenheit heating so far, many of these forests are burning and dying, and they're not absorbing carbon anymore. The oceans are saturated now with carbon. They can't absorb much more of our carbon pollution. There's the permafrost up in Siberia and northern Alaska. It's starting to melt. It's releasing methane just from the heating we've caused so far. So we have to drastically slash our own carbon pollution to keep society on the safe side of the tipping point.
If we, just to balance out what the carbon that's being released, extra carbon, get that, folks.
Right, and our emissions have been increasing by 3% a year. In other words, we haven't even stabilized emissions. So if we don't do that, then the scientists say we could experience 11.5 degree Fahrenheit heating and then beyond. Nobody says that's survivable. That's not survivable to have 11.5 Fahrenheit average temperature temperature heating. So our need is greater than the need in World War II. We have to save literally the survivability of this planet. That means everybody ought to be operating in emergency mode right now. Every single governmental agency should be tackling this issue. So citizens need to be on the phone with their city councils, their mayors, their county commissioners, their legislators, the president's office, saying this is the most urgent issue that faces society. Because government actually holds a lot of the power still. They have all of our taxes. They have all the regulatory power. They have huge resources and public lands. And without government, we can't hope to tackle this. But our government, unlike World War II, is not on our side in this. It is not defending the citizens as it did in World War II. So that is the number one message we have to get across.
And how's that going? Do you think that any progress is being made toward what you're saying about the government taking leadership. I mean, basically, it's going to have to be strong stuff that people won't like. I guess that's why they don't do it.
Well, I think people will like it if they realize their survival depends on it. People have a lot of interest in their kids' college accounts. You can just throw those out the window. This is far more important than college. There's not going to be college for kids in the scenarios we're looking at if we don't stay on the safe side of the tipping point. There's not going to be survivability for humans across this planet. Mm-hmm. So viewed in that sense, every person ought to view this as the number one voting issue. But is there any progress? No. Look at the Oregon State Legislature. They couldn't pass anything meaningful this session. They're asking a regulatory agency to come back in a few years with a proposal. Well, right now, the scientists think that the tipping point is at 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. In other words, they measure carbon in the atmosphere, and they're saying what they think is the tipping point. 2 years ago, they thought that tipping point was 450 parts per million. But in 2007, late 2007, the Arctic just started collapsing. The ice sheets were collapsing, and predictions were just blowing through the roof in that we thought there would be no more summer sea ice by 2040. Within a year, that was changed to 2012. So what that did was cause scientists to go back and say, we think the tipping point is much lower than 450. Jim Hansen, one of the greatest climate scientists in the world, says the tipping point must be around 350. We are at 383. Now, people should still think there's hope. He still gives hope because he says it's like an overshoot in a cholesterol, sort of a cholesterol situation where you can be in a danger zone for a very, very short time and pull back. But our goal now is to draw down this carbon, this lethal carbon that's basically formed a greenhouse. You know, people can think of it as a greenhouse roof over our planet. We're trapped inside. So we have to draw down that carbon immediately. Is the legislature doing it? No, they're not doing it all. They said for an agency to come back in a few years with a plan. They have no concept of the tipping point. In fact, most legislators are not informed at all on this issue. If you ask your legislator, do you know what 350 means? And if they say no, that means they have not done their homework. They are not an adequate trustee.
Yeah. Well, that's easy to believe. They're not informed about a lot of things. And there is a lot to be informed about. It's work. It's not that easy. So, Mary Wood, do you have a chance to talk to the legislature yourself?
I gave a briefing a couple of years ago, and I was amazed, and it was just to one committee. I was amazed at the lack of knowledge they had. I'll go back to my trust construct. If you put your money in a bank account, that banker has to have knowledge of what's going on in the market. And if they don't, they're negligent. What we're facing now is trustees and government of our natural assets that are operating under a system of negligence. They're not informing themselves. They take whatever issues come in the door and assign it the priority that the voters give. So that's why the voters must say right now, we're holding you to a higher standard of accountability. You have to actually manage these resources in accordance with scientific standards.
Well, and I'm thinking about all the laws that were passed without any of the legislators knowing anything about it. They just vote for it. I mean, it's just really not good. And it's going to take, as you say, really monumental changes. And it's certainly monumental changes in our lifestyle. So I hope a lot of people are hearing this. I know that you speak often.
Yeah, I'll comment about the changes in the lifestyle. This is actually really positive and hopeful for people. It doesn't mean we go back and live in caves by any means. It means actually that we can live a much more enriched life. The strategy is to relocalize, to bring food home, to grow food at home and within a few miles of your community. That means people need to get engaged in gardening, bicycle transportation, raising kids in a different way so they're not high-carbon parents. A lot of kids right now are being transported all over the place for sports. That's very high-carbon parenting. It's going to destroy those kids' future. I recommend, and I've done it myself, with great enrichment to our family, just focusing more on the home front. Getting kids involved in gardening, setting up school gardens, bicycling everywhere to activities. The kids just love it. We preserve all of our own food. We set up a home food supply that will last through the winter, all from local foods. We do drying of foods, dry storage of foods, even storage in the ground of some of the roots, root vegetables. So this is going back to the basics, going back to some of the old-fashioned ways. We've really lost touch with those ways, and we've lost a lot of the things that make families so great. We've lost the American family in all this rush to have perfection and consumerism.
Yeah. Things have actually changed dramatically just in the last 10 years in a not good way. I mean, besides the environment, the culture has really dramatically changed in my lifetime in ways that are not very good. And, of course, all this is going to be combined with peak oil, too, which is in a certain way a really good thing because a lot of the carbon in the air comes from burning oil. And we have so many converging catastrophes at the same time, but climate change kind of overshadows everything else.
Well, the nice thing about relocalization as a strategy is that it addresses all of the converging crises in a very positive way. People who relocalize are the happiest people I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And they build community, they build their neighborhoods, and they're addressing economic crisis because by growing food at home, you save incredible amounts of money. They address family crisis because they have their kids at home who take on a sense of responsibility. They're learning what they need to learn for this world. They're addressing the climate crisis by lowering carbon and also peak oil by getting more self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. So this is a one-stop strategy that can transform our entire society. But we can't do it if people just sit by. People didn't just sit by in World War II. They all chipped in, and it became a patriotic effort. And that's what we need today is when you walk down the street and you see these gardens popping up in people's front yards, that is patriotism. That's saying, I take responsibility for my children, for your children. I'm going to make a better world, and I want you to jump in too.
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds good. Well, maybe we can make a little shift here over to your work with Native people and toxins and the water, and you can say more about it. We don't have a lot of time, but I'd like people to know about it.
Well, I do a lot of work in federal Indian law, and what I've noticed there is really the same nature's trust paradigm evident as the prevailing paradigm on this continent for 10,000 years. The tribal people managed the resources as a trust for future generations. It became part of their governance. Their art of governance was much different than ours, and I think the only sustainable way. And so I do look to Native governance as an example. That this can be done, this philosophy of preserving natural assets for future generations and living off the interest of the earth rather than as capital. It can be done. It has been done.
I feel very clear about that. It's important for us to look, for myself anyway, and I guess I could say us, to look to people who have been living sustainably on the earth for a very long time, and that is indigenous people all over the world. And, well, as we speak, actually, indigenous people in Peru are standing up against the government for letting more oil drilling go on, and they're getting massacred. So it's not an easy struggle, that's for sure, but it's one that just has to be made, as you're saying.
That's absolutely right. And I think that the world ahead is going to have to involve a real convergence of values here. Industrialism, as we've known it, has brought us to planetary collapse. It's not just carbon pollution. It's also the oceans are dying. The oceans are becoming so acidic that shellfish can no longer survive because the acid erodes their shells. There's dead zones in the ocean stretching tens of thousands of miles. Every single big commercial fishery in the world is at the point of collapse. 30% of the world's species are going to be threatened with extinction because of climate and pollution and everything else. So our ways, which have only endured for 150 years, they are dead end. We have got to find true conservation and sustainability and lesser impact.
Have you been getting any real positive reactions to your presentations and your outreach?
Oh, absolutely. One of the models I often turn to is the victory speakers model of World War II. There were 100,000 victory speakers in World War II, especially a lot here in Oregon, who went out and used any forum they could to spread the word about what people needed to do to help the war effort. We need climate victory speakers today. And in every one of my speeches, people come up to me and they say, I'm going to be a climate victory speaker. So thousands or hundreds of thousands of people across this world now are, whether they call themselves it or not, they're becoming climate victory speakers. This is a whole movement rising, which I'm just a very tiny part. But I urge all of your listeners, wake up tomorrow, become a climate victory speaker, and live your life differently than you did today, so we can get off this lethal track we're on. And in being a climate victory speaker, go out and use any forum, schools or PTA meetings or soccer games or grocery store conversations, anything, to spread the word on a person-to-person basis that this is the most important thing facing you and your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I find that really a hard thing to do. I mean, I haven't taken that on to be a speaker in groups, but I'm so often, you know, don't talk about negative things. It's really deep, this, not people not wanting to hear.
Well, it's very deep, but, you know, I would say, what about a cancer patient who gets a diagnosis and doesn't want to think about it? What happens to that person, as opposed to someone who really takes on a challenge and overcomes it and survives because of it? This is something we can't ignore. I mean, if we ignore it, basically we create a death sentence for our children and grandchildren. We can't ignore it. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we've got to take it on. The positive thing is, if we take it on, we may create a much better society than we've known for the last 20 years.
Well, I don't doubt that. So do you think there's a movement building here in Oregon and across the country, the world?
There's absolutely a movement building. Millions of people are changing their lives, and people are dropping their jobs to advocate for responsibility and climate. The one institution out to lunch is the government. So we need to get on the phones and write emails and letters and be persistent and meet with every single agency you can possibly think of, from the Parks Department to the school board. I mean, don't leave out the local agencies. They are tremendously important. Mm-hmm. And write letters to the editor and call your legislators. Churches are getting very involved. There's a huge national religious movement galvanized around climate crisis. They are doing amazing things. So now we just need the government on our side. It can't be against us in the threat to survival. Uh-huh. We'll never win if it's against us.
Right. So would you give your website or how you get some of the facts and figures and, you know, really plug into this?
Yeah, I have constructed a website to be of use to people. So if they Google Mary Wood, they'll get me. It'll come up and they'll see my website, University of Oregon School of Law. The easiest way to get there is Google Mary Wood. And when they get to my website, they should click on speeches. And under speeches, you'll find a lot of my speeches that have footnotes with scientific references to all the studies and the statistics I mentioned. But go to the Victory Speakers page. I've got a little page for Victory Speakers and a few of the speeches. People can send my work around and use it in whatever way they want to help spread the message.
Sounds good. Again, the website?
It's just Google Mary Wood, and you'll find my website at the law school, University of Oregon School of Law.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much, Mary Wood. And you are, of course, a professor at the University of Oregon Law School. And thank you so much for your work. And listeners, move along. Let's get together and do something about this. I mean, because you do give us a lot of inspiration. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you for the interview, and thank you, listeners.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. For more information and to hear other Steppin' Out of Babylon shows, go to suesupriano.com. That's spelled SUESUPRIANO.com.
If you'd like to obtain a copy of this program, you can contact WINGS. Our email is wings@wings.org. Our website, www.wings.org. WINGS thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy and Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.